who, having brought lunch to his parents, is packing up to go, the solution to Bayoudin lies far beyond power, politics, or science. A devoted believer in the rapture, as are his parents, Derwin describes the approach of the end times. Quoting from the Book of Revelation, he says, "The earth will burn with fervent heat. Fire purifies, so the planet will be purified 1,000 years from now. And until then, the devil is on the rampage," Derwin says. "In the Garden of Eden, there wasn't anything hurting your environment. We'll probably never see the bayou like God made it in the beginning until he fixes it himself. And that will happen pretty shortly. So it don't matter how much man destroys." Harold and Annette look forward to the rapture, too. But they want man to repair the earth before it comes. They've already waited long enough and nearly despair of politics. A commission to study the pollution, partnering with industry, had been meeting occasionally for decades. Newcomers to Lake Charles were not privy to this history of pollution, and the Tourist Bureau had no interest in reviving the memory of it. Buried with the memory of the damage, too, was a general appreciation of the extraordinary fortitude that had been called upon in Harold and Annette Areno over so many years. At least the Lord remembered what they'd endured, and remembered the courage it took to endure it. As I take leave of the Arenos, I ask them about the lawsuit they have filed against the polluters of Bayoudin. 53 plaintiffs, residents on the bayou and workers in nearby companies, had sued 22 companies. "We're still waiting," Harold answers. Nothing could fully make up for the loss of trees, birds, and fish from their beloved bayou, but the Arenos are hoping mightily that the lawsuit will at least provide money to move. For despite their attachment to the place, their distrust of the water, the banks, the air, makes them feel like refugees in their own home. If they win the suit, it will be a moral victory, a remembered fact. A lawyer who worked in the firm that filed their suit, the lead lawyer had passed away, tells me with a sigh that it is common corporate strategy, with the cooperation of the state agencies, to string these lawsuits out for so long that plaintiffs die before money is due. Still, much time has passed. Among the plaintiffs in this suit, I am astonished to learn, is a man I have already met, Lee Sherman. Lee and the Arenos had played different roles in the pollution of Bayoudin, but each recognized the other as a victim. They'd become good friends. In 2012, all three were watching speeches by a Republican presidential candidate, Mitt Romney. He wouldn't help the country clean up dirty rivers, they thought. But as an opponent to the right to abortion, he was for saving all those babies. And that seemed to them the more important moral issue on which they would be ultimately judged. Harold walks me to my car. I get in, open my window, and fasten my seatbelt. "We're on this earth for a limited amount of time," he says, leaning on the edge of the window. "But if we get our souls saved, we go to heaven, and heaven is for eternity. We'll never have to worry about the environment from then on. That's the most important thing. I'm thinking long term." 4. The Candidates. Under a big tent in the restored Acadian village outside Lafayette, Louisiana, the accordion is leading the fiddle, guitar, and washboard in a catchy, fast-paced, Zydeco-Cajun swamp-pop tune. Middle-aged women in jerseys, Bermuda shorts, and sneakers draw partners up from their picnic tables to the dance floor. Men in cowboy hats with curled brims, two-step, and a few teenage girls with swinging ponytails move in well-practiced jitterbugs with mothers or grandmothers. Two cooks in tall white hats briefly join in. Picnickers in the mainly white crowd chuckle as a toddler is led to the bandstand with a tiny washboard hung on his neck and distractedly runs a stick over it. Elsewhere, children scamper between festive face painting, balloon vendors, and snow cone stands. Dishes of pork, beans, rice, and gumbo are lined up on a long table to the side of the tent, and an enormous basket of cracklins passes from table to table. It is a balmy Saturday, an hour's drive east from Bayou Din. I've come to the Bustani Boucherie, a public pig roast and campaign whistle stop, for the Republican U.S. Congressman Charles Bustani. In this 2012 election, he is running in a tight race against fellow U.S. Congressman and Tea Party caucus member Jeff Landry. Until recently, Landry had represented District 3, while Bustani represented District 7. After the 2010 census reflected a loss of population, each seat has to represent roughly the same number of people, Louisiana lost one seat, and like musical chairs, the two men crisscrossed the same territory event after event, competing for the one remaining seat. The pig roast is held in a park commemorating the mid-19th century life of Acadian settlers, later called Cajuns, in southwest Louisiana. Within the village green are simple, restored wood houses with mud walls and tin roofs. Clustered around a pond and majestic Evangeline oaks are a blacksmith shop, a spinning and weaving house, and a small Catholic church whose wooden sign reads, La Chapelle du Nouvel Espoir, 1850, Chapel of New Hope. An old, rusted harrowing machine and plow stand motionless in the nearby grass, and a wooden shed shelters a 27-foot dugout canoe such as Harold Arino's father built for fishermen on Bayou Din. How, I wonder, as I sit down at a picnic table, do politicians such as Bustani and Landry deal with Bayou Din or other places like it on Mike Tritico's napkin map? Do they remember what happened? Would they help such people as Lee Sherman or Harold and Annette Arino? If they call for smaller federal government, how do they propose to fix the problems that form part of the great paradox that has brought me to Louisiana? I ask myself again, how people in a poor state with the worst health in the nation can look askance at a federal government that provides 44% of its state budget, and how such a polluted state can take a dim view of government regulation of polluters. A political campaign has a central place in the cultural life of a people. It tells citizens what issues powerful people think are worth hearing about. I was backing into the picture I wanted to see by noticing what wasn't in it. It was like trying to understand a photograph by studying the negative. I found myself focusing not on what people remembered, focused on, and said, but on what they forgot, disregarded, and did not say. I was backing into the deep story, as I am calling it, and noticing what, in human consciousness, it crowded out. My developing focus on silence was not a reward for some brave climb over the empathy wall. I was still way over on my side of it, saying to myself, if the Louisiana environment is in such a mess, I hope these politicians talk about cleaning it up. If not, why not? Something commonsensical was beginning to seem mysterious. Many of the Tea Party people I met seemed to me warm, intelligent, generous. Not like people out of the frightening pages of Ayn Rand. They have community and church and goodwill toward those they know. Many, like Lee Sherman and Harold and Annette Arino, care deeply about the environment. But for each of them, there was something else I was coming to realize that was even more important. Taxes? Church? That seemed part of it. But were these the whole story? Congressman Bustani was a mainstream Republican, popular with his constituency, with a reputation for honesty, a trained surgeon but a regular guy, pro-oil. He was a man who could get money from Washington, but also make jabs at the Washington elite. He could both complain about Washington being too out of touch and put you in touch with it. The Boucherie d'Or Prize was a symbol of the federal government, a congressional club cookbook with a homemade Christmas ornament made by Mrs. Bustani wrapped in a small American flag, which by some fluke I won. People blamed their woes on Washington, but prized attachment to it too. Jeff Landry was a Tea Party Republican, which, according to one 2011 poll, had won the sympathy of nearly half of Louisiana voters. So I was curious what differences between the two men would emerge. After a while, the band stops. Dancers sit down. Congressman Bustani, bespectacled and balding, rises to the podium and begins. "We've been through hurricanes together. We've been through a moratorium on oil drilling that hurt jobs. We've been through a financial and economic crisis. Louisiana needs conservative leadership you can trust." In a later radio interview, he boasts that he defeated a bill to tax oil and gas companies that would have raised $60 billion, opposed a moratorium on drilling after the BP disaster, and voted for the Keystone Pipeline. At a rice and beans supper at a union hall in Rain a few days later, his rival, Congressman Landry, a former sugarcane field worker and policeman with a heavy Cajun drawl, makes a remarkably similar speech, only adding periodically, "If it ain't good for y'all, I ain't voting for it." You can take a high school graduate, and I know some people that didn't even finish high school, Landry says, work that tail off in the oil and gas industry, and make better money than most people make anywhere else in this country. He continues, "I'm tired of the government being in my business. When I was struggling and we needed help, I never went straight to the government. You know where I went? I went into my church. I went into my community. I mean, who built the hospitals in this country? You go back and look. Our Lady of Lourdes. That ain't the government, okay? All those Baptist hospitals up in the Midwest and the Catholic hospitals on the East Coast, that wasn't the government. That was people helping people. The answers to our problems are right here in places just like Rain." But questions from the floor in this mainly older crowd focus on how to get more and better federal government services. "Why haven't the over 65 received a cost of living raise on their Social Security check?" one man asks. Landry's answer is to retire later. Another asks about Medicare. Another elderly woman complains that she has to pay $28 to hire a cab to get to the doctor. "Why isn't there free van transport for seniors?" To these questions, Landry has no answers. A few days after a union hall meet-and-greet in Crowley, Congressman Landry speaks at a boat parade in New Iberia. Some in the crowd are munching on devil hot dogs, chili sauce, mustard, and sugar, along with fried chicken and double chocolate whiskey caramel brownies. "We have to take our country back from a government that has ignored our Constitution, dismissed our conservative values, and spent our tax dollars like drunken sailors. Of course, that's unfair to the sailors," Landry declares to a nodding crowd. About a third of the gathering are black, and there seem to be quite a few multiracial picnic groupings of families and friends. Some there more for the food and music, I am told by two white attendants, than the politics. One black woman confides, "Oh, I'm voting for Obama. We have really poor people here. My 21-year-old grandson says he's going to vote Republican, but I don't know if he means it or he's just trying to raise my blood pressure." In all the speeches between the Pledge of Allegiance at the beginning and the invitations to gumbo cook-offs at the end, I am again struck by what both candidates avoid saying, that the state ranks 49th out of 50 on an index of human development, that Louisiana is the second poorest state, that 44% of its budget comes from the federal government. The great paradox. At the same time, the rivals both express and promote a culture that has produced the great paradox. They disdain insider Washington while trying to pry as much money from it for Louisiana as they can. The two men verge on but refrain from competing for how many government agencies they would strip away, as other prominent Southern Republicans have done. In the 2012 presidential race, Texas Governor Rick Perry called for abolishing three federal departments, though during a nationally televised debate, he famously forgot the third one. They were commerce, education, and energy. Republican Ron Paul called for eliminating the Internal Revenue Service, FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Agency, and the Department of Health and Human Services. As mentioned, Congressman David Vitter called for axing the EPA. On my keyhole issue, the story was this. The seat of District 3, the parish of Lafayette, which the two were competing to represent, is one of the most polluted counties in the nation. The district includes companies on Mike Tritico's napkin map, as well as the half-remembered, half-forgotten tragedy of Bayou Din. In 2015, of the 9 main waterways in the parish, the EPA listed 8 as impaired and the 9th as unassessed. In 2015, Lafayette Parish also had 100 facilities with current violations of the law and 89 with formal enforcement actions in the last 5 years, according to the EPA. Most of those I interviewed voted for Bustani, who won. But all along the campaign trail, I heard not a word about Bustani's vote to roll back regulation of Wall Street, a measure that would strengthen monopolies and hurt small business people, many of whom were Tea Party members. I heard nothing about federal and state subsidies to oil companies, lowered corporate taxes, the role of oil in the erosion of the Louisiana coast, or unclean waters. Their voting records told where they stood. Bustani voted to cut funds for the Environmental Protection Agency, to block fuel efficiency standards for cars, to ban federal fracking safeguards, to halt Clean Air Act protections for smog, soot, and mercury pollution, and to gut the core of the Clean Water Act, the federal floor of water quality standards that states must meet. He voted to redefine healthy air, basing the definition of it on the feasibility and cost to polluting industries, and not on human health. Representative Landry did the same. On the League of Conservation Voters scorecard of members of Congress, both Bustani and Landry had earned a lifetime score of 6 out of a total possible 100. Louisiana produced 31 pounds of toxic release per person to air, water, and land in 2012. By comparison, the United States as a whole produced 11 pounds per capita. Neither candidate said a word about all this. Silence on the environment extended to the minor candidates in this race as well. At a Meet You at the Polls gathering of several hundred citizens in Crowley, a libertarian vowed to get the government out of the way so Louisiana can plant hemp in rice fields. A Democrat began, "I don't agree with everything the Democratic Party or the president say," before declaring himself pro-life, pro-marriage, pro-gun, and pro-oil. Only one candidate came out for protecting our coast, in part because it would protect our energy industry. At a Landry Union Hall campaign stop, 36 retired plant workers sit around wooden picnic tables eating a rice and bean dinner from paper plates. When it comes up, they speak of the Democratic Party as a tattered memory from a distant past. One man says that he'd been waiting until his father died before he voted Republican, a comment greeted with knowing laughter around the table. Another man adds, "The only Democrat left in my family is my wife, and she's voting for Landry." More laughter. A former so-called Blue Dog Democratic state, since 1970, Louisiana has voted Republican in 7 out of 10 presidential elections. And in such older white crowds, this shift rightward seems bound to continue. As one man explains, "A lot of us have done okay, but we don't want to lose what we've got, see it given away." When I ask him what he saw as being given away, it was not public waters given to dumpers, or clean air given to smokestacks. It was not health or years of life. It was not lost public sector jobs. What he felt was being given away was tax money to non-working, non-deserving people. And not just tax money, but honor, too. If that tax money could come back to citizens as a sort of raise in the midst of a 3-decade-long national economic lull, why not? As with Mike Schaff, Lee Sherman, and the Arenos, conversations moved toward this rift between deserving taxpayers and undeserving tax money takers, those in a class below them. Repeatedly, I was to find, this rift was an emotional flashpoint, especially for men who worked in oil and other predominantly male jobs in the private sector. But it was a guy thing to hunt and fish, too, and these days, if the ducks they shot ate fish from Bayou Din, it took some of the fun out of hunting. Still, if it is between animals and people, the man at the Landry Union Hall table concludes, people matter more. These days, American men are an endangered species, too. The General, The Psychological Program, and Just Enough Talk of Jobs. Meanwhile, a potential candidate for governor of Louisiana has broken the silence on the environment held all along this campaign trail. He's dressed in army fatigues and stands 6 feet 5 inches tall when he gets up from a Baton Rouge hotel breakfast table to greet me. We adjourn to a conference room, where he sits, takes off a military cap bearing 3 large stars, and lays it on the table. A much-decorated lieutenant general in the U.S. Army. In September of 2005, General Russell Honoré led the Joint Task Force and 1,000 National Guardsmen to rescue stranded residents of New Orleans, overwhelmed by the floodwaters and chaos of Hurricane Katrina. Taking up that job after it was famously bungled by FEMA Chief Michael Brown, a Bush contributor and Oklahoma lawyer with an interest in horses, Honoré became known as a Category 5 general, a term used to describe storms. He reminded guardsmen to point their guns down because, "We're on a rescue mission, damn it!" Beloved to thousands of rescued Katrina flood victims, the general became a statewide legend. Born the youngest of 12 children in Pointe Coupe Parish, south of New Orleans, the general is by origin Black Creole, though people affectionately call him the Ragin' Cajun for his wide strides, forceful manner, and authoritative bass voice. The mayor of New Orleans called him a John Wayne kind of dude. But this is a serious underestimation, for the expressions that cross Honoré's long face, with its aquiline nose and thin salt-and-pepper mustache, alternate between compassion, humor, thoughtfulness, and indignation. He's an empathy wall leaper. "I have nothing against oil and gas making money in Louisiana," the general begins matter-of-factly. "But the oil companies need to clean up after themselves. and they haven't. They need to fix what they break, and they haven't. And pretty much theirs is the only voice we hear. Why, I ask Honoré, don't citizens ask politicians to clean up their environment? The general pauses. All the people in Louisiana hear is jobs, jobs, jobs. And there's just enough to it that people slip into believing it's the whole story. Really, they're captives of a psychological program. Honoré has called for cleanup of polluted rivers and abandoned oil wells, and for monitoring devices inside industrial plants, similar to those in airplane cockpits, to tell what has caused a disaster. In recent years, the general has also led what he calls the Green Army, a consortium of small environmental groups. I wasn't aware of the extent of our problem until I looked out the window of the helicopter that took me to New Orleans after Katrina, the general says. The landscape was littered for miles with debris. I remember commenting to the pilot, the storm must have caused that mess, and hearing back, no, those are abandoned oil derricks from years back. After an hour, Honoré offers to drive me in his truck along River Road, which parallels the Mississippi River between Baton Rouge and New Orleans, a span now popularly known as Cancer Alley. You see the river? The general points his arm out the window at the Mississippi. I am reminded of Mark Twain's Life on the Mississippi, and looking at the map, I had been charmed by the names of the towns along it. Convent, St. Gabriel, St. Rose, St. James. I knew that here, over half of the nation's grain and a fifth of its other exports floated to the Gulf and out to the world. You know what you're looking at? Honoré asked. I thought I did. That's not the Mississippi's water. That's Monsanto water, Exxon water, Shell Oil water. It's a public waterway, but that's private water. Industry owns the Mississippi now. There's hardly a public dock along it. The Great River has long been polluted, it turns out. Back in the 1950s, one man told me, a steamboat left New Orleans propelled by freshly painted red paddles. By the time it had arrived upriver in Natchez, the red paint had vanished. Riding in the general's truck, as in Mike Schaff's truck, through the sugar plantation, I become aware of what I can't see. With Schaff, it was history. With the general, it was pollution. Indeed, most of the pollution in Louisiana is invisible to the naked eye. We drive through Gonzales, a small town situated along Cancer Alley that is promoted by the Louisiana Visitors Bureau as the jambalaya capital of the world. Gonzales is the site of springtime festivals in which cooks stir enormous pots filled with 700 pounds of rice. Nearby is a fisherman's haven, heralded by LouisianaTravel.com, near places great for hiking and wildlife watching. The site offers a Cajun Pride swamp tour, too. Gonzales seems to be a one-town ongoing party, above ground. But the jambalaya capital is sadly located on one of the most polluted industrial strips in the world. 150 facilities line the two sides of the Mississippi, an 85-mile strip, each plant surrounded by chain-link fences, some with entrances whose signs proudly announce the small number of workdays missed due to accidents. Many plants were built on former cotton and sugarcane plantations. Other towns along River Road, Plaquemine, St. Gabriel, Geismar, Donaldsonville, lie in parishes that in 2013 ranked in the top 3% of U.S. counties in reported toxic releases, according to the EPA. Louisiana is the nation's sixth leading state in generating hazardous waste, and it is third in the nation for the amount of hazardous waste it imports from other states. We import hazardous waste from Arkansas, the general continues, eyes wide as if in disbelief. because they've got stricter regulations than we do. Throughout the state, there are many injection wells drilled deep underground and surrounded by casing into which hazardous waste is pumped, and worrisome studies had occasionally appeared in the press about them. Louisiana has a lot of oil, the general continues, and a lot of people think that's a blessing. And if done well, it could be. But it's not done well. Companies, he points out, have drilled over 220,000 wells, found 600 producing oil fields, and built 8,000 miles of pipelines and canals in this state. Over 25,000 miles of underwater pipelines connect offshore drilling platforms to onshore refineries in Louisiana and Texas. But the companies put the state government in their pockets, the general points out, and people pay the price. He pulls his truck alongside an embankment bordering the Mississippi on the campus of Southern University, a formerly all-black college, his alma mater. We get out and walk across the grass to gaze at the river. He points to an island far across the way. You see the tip of that island? They call that Free Nigger Point, because if a man could swim across the river to it, he could reach the Underground Railroad, and he was free. Many couldn't swim and drowned. But today, if he gulped the water, he'd get sick and die gradually of pollution. The spill makes us sad. The moratorium makes us mad. Combining what I could not hear in the speeches of Congressmen Bustani and Landry with what I could not see out the window of the general's truck, I began to understand how easy it would be to forget or ignore the problems with Louisiana's environment. But what if a disaster was so spectacular, so visible for miles, so long-lasting, so publicized, and so far into the arena of never before that you couldn't ignore it? What would my Tea Party friends say? Of course, just such a spectacular event did occur in 2010. The BP oil rig Deepwater Horizon exploded in the Gulf of Mexico off the coast of Louisiana. President Obama called it the worst environmental disaster America has ever faced. The blowout killed 11 workers and injured 17. It ruptured an oil pipe 10,000 feet below the surface of the water, from which oil gushed into the Gulf continuously for 3 months. The spill released the equivalent of one Exxon Valdez-sized oil spill every 3 to 4 days for 87 days. Highly trained engineers were helpless. Anxious experts testified on television. Louisiana's 397-mile Gulf Coast was critical, they said, to the life cycle of over 90% of all fish and 98% of all commercial species in the entire Gulf of Mexico. Eyeless shrimp and infant dolphins washed ashore, and oil balls appeared along an estimated 650 miles of coastline. Pelicans died, crab traps were soiled, and shrimp harvests were decimated. Oil leaked onto oyster plots. After the blowout, carcasses of 6,000 birds, 600 sea turtles, over 100 bottlenose dolphins, and other marine mammals, including whales, washed ashore. Later studies discovered that embryos of fish, especially tuna, that had been exposed to BP oil, showed distorted body shapes, hearts, and eyes. More bad news followed. Some 90,000 fishermen had lost their livelihood and were offered jobs to clean up the spilled oil using their own boats in the Vessels of Opportunity program. However, their protective gear was inadequate against the oil and the dispersant Corexit, and some developed skin lesions, blurred vision, breathing difficulties, and headaches. In response, President Obama ordered a 6-month moratorium on deep-sea drilling until safeguards could be put in place, reasoning that it was better to have one disaster than two or more. No one knew for sure why the accident had occurred. At that time, the blowout preventer BP had used had never before been used at a depth of 10,000 feet. Even the robots used to explore the site of the blowout had never before been used, so no one knew if they would work. 32 other rigs were still drilling in the Gulf, using similar technology at such depths. BP itself did not object to the moratorium. Altogether, it seemed to many a wise step. But months later, a team of Louisiana State University researchers asked some 2,000 residents of the devastated coast, "Do you favor or oppose a moratorium that would halt offshore drilling until new safety requirements are met?" Half opposed it, and only a third favored it. When asked, "Have your views about other environmental issues, such as global warming or protecting wildlife, changed as a result of the oil spill?" 7 out of 10 answered no. The rest, interestingly the less educated and female, said yes. The inland Louisianans I spoke with, like Congressman Bustani and Landry, were also adamantly opposed to Obama's moratorium. Why? Loss of drilling revenue was one thing, but federal government overregulation was another. It's not in the company's own interest to have a spill or an accident. They try hard, one woman told me. So if there's a spill, it's probably the best the company could do. Another recalled all the everyday things we use that are made from oil. One man even declared that what caused the spill was overregulation. If the government hadn't been looking over BP's shoulder, it would have regulated itself, and the spill wouldn't have happened. One woman summed it up, "The spill makes us sad, but the moratorium makes us mad." The governor and senators of the state called for an end to the moratorium. In partial response, President Obama ended it a month early, but that earned him no points with those I spoke with. "What did Obama know up there in Washington?" they asked. In the speeches of the two congressmen a few years later, not a word was said about the spill. Maybe, I thought, the coastal Louisianans who opposed the ban were expressing loyalty to the oil industry and private sector and falling into a historic refrain against the federal government. But given their vulnerability to loss and contamination, maybe they were managing strong feelings of anxiety, fear, and anger about what they already knew. Maybe they were saying to themselves, "We can't afford to worry about this. We need to set thoughts of it aside, manage our anxiety, and not acknowledge that we're doing so." With this in mind, I returned to the great paradox. From my initial perspective, Louisiana, like other red states, was coping with a great number of challenges. Perhaps for better-off people of the far right, problems such as poverty, poor schools, and medical care didn't come up because such problems didn't hit them directly. Pollution hit better-off people, too, but they seemed braced to tough it out. As for blame, it seemed as if Dad had left a dreadful mess, and you blamed Mom because Mom's used to absorbing blame for what goes wrong and trying to fix it, and she's still there. At least, it seemed like that at first. Freedom to, freedom from, freedom for whom? So how did Louisianans look at government regulation of any sort? I thought an answer to that might help me understand the coastal Louisianans who were sad at the spill but mad at the government. Maybe it was government regulations in general they resented. At first glance, Louisiana's own policies seemed flamboyantly opposed to the very idea of regulation. With regard to alcohol, Louisiana is one of the most permissive states in the nation. You can pull into a drive-through frozen daiquiri stand and buy daiquiris in go-cups, the only legal proviso being that the plastic lid is pressed on and the straw is not yet inserted. At a Caribbean hut in Lake Charles, a satisfied customer reported ordering a 32-ounce Long Island iced tea with a few extra shots, a piece of scotch tape placed over the straw hole so it was sealed, and drove on. And only in 2004 did it become illegal to drive with unsealed containers. There is even a late July Defend the Daiquiri Festival held in New Orleans, supported, naturally, by an alcohol lobbying group. An unlicensed vendor can sell handguns, shotguns, rifles, or assault weapons, and large-capacity magazines. A person can buy any number of guns and, except for handguns, need not register them or report a theft of one or hesitate to take them into parking lots and state parks. Louisiana also has a Stand Your Ground law, permitting a frightened homeowner to shoot first. A person can walk into a bar on Bourbon Street in New Orleans with a loaded gun. Indeed, a gun vendor in Louisiana can keep no records, perform no background checks, and sell guns to an array of customers forbidden in other states, those with violent and firearms-related misdemeanors, people on terror watch lists or no-fly lists, abusers of drugs or alcohol, juvenile offenders, and criminals with a history of serious mental illness or domestic violence. In 2010, the governor passed a law that permitted concealed handguns in churches, synagogues, and mosques. Louisiana has the highest rate of death by gunfire in the country, nearly double the national average. Still, many I talked to were ardent believers in the right to bear arms. Mike Schaff had four guns. A .22 rifle, a .22 pistol that I got when Daddy died, a .40 Smith & Wesson automatic, and a 12-gauge shotgun. These killed varmint or deer, he explained, while the Smith & Wesson's for self-defense. He went on to describe his first wife's rifle and another long Kentucky rifle, a show gun he had assembled from a kit. But he now had four, which he described as nothing for the South. Most have seven or eight guns. He didn't have a conceal and carry permit, he added, but said he would get it eventually if things got worse. Looked at more closely, an overall pattern in state regulation emerges, and the great paradox becomes more complicated than it first seemed. Liquor, guns, motorcycle helmets, legislation had gone back and forth on that, mainly white masculine pursuits, are fairly unregulated. But for women and black men, regulation is greater. Within given parameters, federal law gives women the right to decide whether or not to abort a fetus. But the state of Louisiana has imposed restrictions on clinics offering the procedure, which, if upheld in the U.S. Supreme Court, would prevent all but one clinic in New Orleans from offering women access to it. Any adult in the state can also be jailed for transporting a teenager out of state for the purposes of an abortion if the teen has not informed her parents. Young black males are regulated, too. Jefferson Davis Parish passed a bill banning the wearing of pants in public that revealed skin beneath their waists or their underwear, and newspaper accounts featured images taken from the back of two black teenage boys exposing large portions of their undershorts. The parish imposed a $50 fine for a first offense and $100 for a second. A town ordinance in Ville Platte, in which 54% of the population is black, requires residents to wear something reflective and visible from all directions on an outer garment when walking after dark. Next to the death sentence, prisons are the ultimate instrument of regulation. The United States incarcerates a higher proportion of its population than does any nation in the world outside the Seychelles Islands, more than Russia or Cuba. Louisiana incarcerates the highest proportion of its population of all the states in the Union, and those inmates are disproportionately black. It also houses Angola, the nation's largest maximum security prison, in which rules are notoriously harsh. The prison is the site of the longest-standing case of solitary confinement in the nation. A black man, Albert Woodfox, who had been locked up for 23 out of every 24 hours a day for 43 years before finally being released on February 19, 2016. So while the state boasts a reputation of an almost cowboy-style, don't-fence-me-in freedom, that is probably not how a female rape victim who wants an abortion, or a young black boy in Jefferson Davis Parish, or Albert Woodfox, see the matter. Yet when people spoke indignantly of regulation, it was not abortion clinics and prisons that came to mind, but rather what the government was telling them to buy in stores. At a meeting of the Republican Women of Southwest Louisiana, across-the-table talk of regulation focused on the promotion of fluorescent or LED light bulbs. "The government has no right to regulate the light bulbs we buy," one woman declared. "I made my husband change all my light bulbs back to the old ones." Others complained of all the forced salads on the menus in fast food restaurants now. "I don't need the government telling me what to eat," one woman complained. "You remember that apron that says, 'If the cook ain't fat, I ain't eating it?'" one woman asked to a round of happy laughter. Others were irritated by a local ban on driving on sidewalks or on having more than one RV in your yard, and still others by child protection devices. One woman recalled an age without childproof lids on medicine bottles or car seat belts. "We let them throw lawn darts, smoked alongside them," she said. "And they survived. Now it's like your kid needs a helmet, knee pads, and elbow pads to go down the kiddie slide." Laughter rippled around the table. Self-service regulation. One Cub Scout den mother named Louise, a warm-hearted bookkeeper and mother of three, lives near a petrochemical plant. She believes the plants should be regulated. "We regulate everything else, why not them?" But had observed events that made her wonder how carefully they actually were. So she kept an informal vigil over nearby plants. "You can go months without a scare," she explains. "Then sometimes you'll hear noises or the windows rattle. You half hold your breath. We'll call, 'Dad, you all right?'" Her father-in-law worked in a plant, and he'll say, "Yeah, everything's fine." "If something happens at Firestone, I'm going to burn up my son-in-law's phone," use the phone a lot, calling everyone who knows somebody at the plant. Other times, she says, "You come over the bridge at night and see haze hanging in the air. We have humid, heavy air in Lake Charles. It's like someone throwing covers over you. And then a smell, and you wonder, what's getting trapped?" She continues, "My house is less than 3 miles from Sitgo, as the crow flies. We had a release today, but they said it didn't leave the confines of their property." With a laugh, she adds, "So me and my neighbor, we go, 'Oh, thank goodness, just to the fence.'" Another woman watched the color of industrial flares rising from nearby plant smokestacks. "If it's a strange color, I'll call up a relative or friend. 'Why is it blue today?' or 'Why is it red?' Or if you hear something or smell something, you turn on the radio or TV and see if there's anything crawling across the screen telling you what's just happened." Around the plants, pollution is personal. "Is the state doing all it can to assure safety?" I asked one man I sat next to at the boat parade in New Iberia. I don't know. Sometimes they don't tell us the truth about what's going on because they don't want to alarm us, he replied. And, of course, we don't want to be alarmed. In 2013, an explosion took place at the Axiall plant, the old PPG with a new name and management, the second in 13 months. It sent massive dark clouds churning upward over Lake Charles, Westlake, and Eastern Sulphur, carrying hydrochloric acid, ethylene dichloride, and vinyl chloride. Drivers caught the event on their cell phones and posted pictures and videos of the clouded sky on YouTube and Facebook. 27 people, most of them drivers caught on the I-10 freeway, were treated in local emergency rooms for trouble breathing. The freeway was closed for 3 hours, and a shelter-in-place command was ordered for the nearby population. But the Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality reported that its detection equipment showed ND, non-detect. Citizens were left to reconcile the fact that their iPhones and computer screens were saying plain, obvious, terrible, and the state was saying didn't see it, can't tell. The general is turning his truck around, and we are returning back up River Road along Cancer Alley to Baton Rouge. I ask him to respond to a question I often heard. If companies want to avoid accidents themselves, why do we need the government? He answered, less regulated industries have more accidents, and more regulated industries have fewer. Regulation works. Then, with a wry smile, he continues, but here we have self-regulation. The federal EPA passes the buck to the State Department of Environmental Quality. The state passes the buck to the oil companies. They regulate themselves. It's like me driving this truck 100 miles an hour down River Road. I call up the highway patrol and say, Officer, excuse me, I'm speeding right now. In all the talk at the gatherings for Congressman Bustani and Landry, and around the table at the Republican Women of Southwest Louisiana, I heard a great deal about freedom in the sense of freedom to talk on your cell phone as you drove a car, to pick up a drive-in daiquiri with a straw on the side, to walk about with a loaded gun. But there was almost no talk about freedom from such things as gun violence, car accidents, or toxic pollution. General Honoré was no nervous Nelly, but he was mindful of the vulnerable communities around the self-regulated plants. Part of the psychological program is that people think they're free when they're not, he said. A company may be free to pollute, but that means the people aren't free to swim. How did the psychological program work? Maybe I was missing the most obvious answer. Jobs. Oil brought jobs. Jobs brought money. Money brought a better life. School, home, health, a piece of the American dream. Maybe it was not so much that the people sitting with me in the audiences of the campaign rallies hated the federal government, but that they loved the private sector, especially the queen of it in Louisiana, oil. Maybe I'd been so busy listening to the unsung tune about cleaning up pollution that I wasn't hearing the loud and clear song about jobs. After all, Jeff Landry had held up a sign in Congress during a speech by President Obama, oil equals jobs. And maybe government regulations were killing them. General Honoré had told me that talk was of jobs, 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 and there was just enough in it that people believed it. He told me that the psychological program involved the belief that there was a terrible choice between jobs and clean water or air. But how many jobs depended on oil? And was it either or? Before I understood government, maybe I had to understand the private sector. Maybe there were tough choices I didn't see. 5. The least resistant personality. Before me is Dr. Paul Templet, a PhD in chemical physics, recently retired from teaching at Louisiana State University, and for 4 years, head of the Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality, during which time pollution of all kinds dropped in half. Templet knows jobs, environment, and trade-offs, and we're seated around a table with coffee and cake to talk about this in a friend's home in Baton Rouge. His manner is friendly, energetic, purposeful. He wears a mustache, goatee, and dark-tinted glasses, and doesn't look his 73 years. He is wearing a rust-colored T-shirt and khaki pants, and lifts his coffee cup to his mouth in a thoughtful manner, as if respecting the importance of the topic at hand more than the coffee. A Cajun born in Port Allen, Louisiana, as a teenager he had unloaded sandbags from railroad cars at Dow Chemical. In the speeches of Congressmen Bustani, Landry, and Vitter, and of Governor Jindal, a certain logic unfolded. These were leaders my Tea Party friends gladly voted into office, and so I wanted to understand this logic, see if it made any sense to me, and figure out why it made sense to them. The logic was this: the more oil, the more jobs. The more jobs, the more prosperity, and the less need for government aid. And the less the people depend on government, local, state, or federal, the better off they will be. So to attract more oil jobs, the state has to offer financial incentives to oil companies to get them to come. That incentive money will have to be drawn from the state budget, which may lead to the firing of public sector workers, which, painful as it might seem, reduces reliance on government and lowers taxes. It is a red state logic, but the paradox is that it goes with being a poor state with a lot of problems. So to begin with, I ask Paul, how many Louisiana jobs are in oil and petrochemical plants? Today, less than 10%, he answers. I am shocked. For all the talk of jobs, this seems below the level that would justify General Honoré's remark that there was just enough to all the talk about jobs that people felt threatened by the word environmental and gave an exasperated sigh at regulation. But later, when I check his figures, I discover that the highest estimate, offered by the Louisiana Mid-Continent Oil and Gas Association, was 15% of all jobs in the state. The lowest, from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, was 3.3%. This included all jobs in oil and gas extraction, support activities for mining, petroleum, and coal products manufacturing, and pipeline transportation in 2014. After all the talk by Congressman Bustani and Landry and others, why so few? The industry is highly automated. To build a petrochemical plant, you need many construction workers for a temporary period, and then their job is over. To run a petrochemical plant, you need a small number of highly trained engineers, chemists, and operators to keep watch over panels of gauges and to know what to do when there's trouble. Then, you need a few repairmen, such as Lee Sherman. But a fracking boom was on, and maybe that meant more jobs coming in. According to the 2014 Sasol-sponsored Southwest Louisiana Regional Impact Study, some 18,000 jobs, a small proportion of them permanent, would open up by 2018. But 7 out of 10 of these jobs would be filled, the report said, by workers from outside Southwest Louisiana. Many companies would recruit professionals from around the world. Construction workers building the man camps, barracks within enclosed encampments, were Mexican, people said. The man camps would house 5,000 pipe fitters, an undisclosed number of them Filipinos on temporary visas. Filipino workers have worked for over a decade on oil platforms in the Gulf. Meanwhile, most permanent jobs in the state, 85% of them, involved doing something else, such as teaching children, nursing the ill, building mobile homes, playground equipment and yachts, repairing aircraft, being stagehands for films being made in what some were calling the Hollywood of the South, conducting tours through plantation manor homes, catching fish, and farming. Perhaps oil jobs took priority in official thinking because oil brought in more state revenue. But severance taxes, fees paid when oil or gas is taken out of the ground from oil, contributed only 14% of the state's budget revenue, down from 42% in 1982. It was the largest single source of revenue, though, and this was the rationale behind Governor Bobby Jindal's plan to lure more oil and petrochemical business to Louisiana. Oil companies also gave him $1 million in campaign money, as my Tea Party interviewees were well aware. Critics also argued that the oil companies would come anyway, since the oil, the pipelines, the petrochemical plants, the port, the whole setup was already there. To offer an incentive, Jindal lowered corporate income taxes so that state revenue from such companies fell from $703 million in 2008 to $290 million in 2012. He lowered oil severance taxes so that the state received over $1 billion in 2008, but less than $886 million in 2012. It also lost another $2.4 billion between 2000 and 2014 because some oil companies were exempted from oil severance taxes altogether. New businesses pay no taxes for the first 10 years. And can, by changing their name, qualify for another tax exemption for the next 10. Indeed, according to the Louisiana Economic Development and Tax Foundation, Louisiana offers the lowest business taxes in the entire country for new manufacturing projects. And for 3 years, it was impossible to tell whether the oil companies paid anything at all to the state, since the job of auditing oil company payments was handed over to the Office of Mineral Resources, which has close ties with the industry, and which, between 2010 and 2013, performed no audits at all. So apart from providing 15% of jobs in Louisiana, oil was providing less and less financial benefit to the state. Oil was costing more to lure to the state, and once there, giving less to it. Meanwhile, to pay for this, public workers were fired, and the state debt, $83 billion in 2012, much of it in unfunded public pension liabilities, remained. Dr. Templay and I are on a second round of coffee and a second layer of revelations. Oil brought in some jobs, Templay says, but it causes other jobs to disappear or simply inhibits other sectors, such as the seafood industry and tourism, from growing. Oil rig explosions, such as the 2010 BP Deepwater Horizon blowout, severely hurt the seafood and tourism industries. Oyster fishermen, deep-sea fishermen, wholesalers, restaurateurs, and hotel workers were impacted. No one wants to eat oil-tainted shrimp or vacation on beaches strewn with tar balls. Despite the implication of the annual Morgan City, Louisiana Shrimp and Petroleum Festival, oil and seafood do not go well together. Oil cut jobs in another way, too. The incentive money Jindal gave oil went hand in hand with the cuts to 30,000 public sector jobs. Nurses, medical technicians, teachers. One defense of oil jobs was that they were highly paid and that salaries would trickle down through consumption that increased jobs and wages of other workers. But did it? Not much, Templet says. That's because oil wages don't trickle down, they leak out. As he explained, most of the plants are owned by foreign companies. Sasol is based in Johannesburg. Royal Dutch Shell is based in The Hague. BP is based in London. Citgo is a wholly owned subsidiary of Petroleos de Venezuela. Magnolia LNG is based in Perth, Australia. Phillips 66, spun off from ConocoPhillips in 2012, is based in the United States, but not in Lake Charles. So most top executives in these companies are not building luxury homes and swimming pools in Lake Charles, Sulphur, or Westlake. Stockholders aren't spending their dollars there either, but rather where they live, in Greenwich, Connecticut, say, or Mill Valley, California. The income of temporary Filipino pipe fitters and Mexican green card holders doesn't trickle down either, since most dutifully send money back to needy families abroad. Indeed, some local citizens complain that imported Filipino workers don't spend their money in local stores. Summing it up, Templet calculates that Louisiana leaks about a third of the gross state product, the sum of the value of all goods and services produced by the state. Thinking again of the great paradox, I ask Templet whether the appearance of oil in Louisiana reduces the state's poverty. No, he answers. Louisiana was poor before oil came, and we're poor today, the second poorest in the U.S. In 1979, 19% of Louisianans lived below the poverty line. In 2014, it was 18%. In addition, ill-schooled poor people of any race find it hard to get the kind of highly skilled permanent jobs oil brings in. And oil hadn't improved the schools. They are financed by local property taxes, which are higher in rich areas and lower in poor ones. Still, 15% of the people did get good jobs. Two-thirds of their salaries didn't leak out. This was good news. But what was the whole picture? Perhaps oil in Louisiana represented a strategy for economic growth conservatives pulled for. What sociologists Caroline Hanley and Michael T. Douglas call a low-road strategy. Union bans, lower wages, corporate tax rebates, and loose implementation of environmental regulations are used as lures to get industry that exists somewhere else to move to one's own state. 50 years ago, such a strategy brought the New England textile industry to the South, and these days it is bringing Mercedes from New Jersey to Georgia, Toyota from California to Texas, and Nissan from California to Tennessee. Louisiana brought jobs into the state, not by nurturing new business in the state, but by poaching jobs in another state. The high road strategy, as the researchers describe it, is to stimulate new jobs by creating an attractive public sector, as California did in Silicon Valley and Washington State did in Seattle. Perhaps, it occurred to me, the first strategy for economic development was backed by one party, the Tea Party, Louisiana model, and the second strategy by another party, the Democratic, California model. Templet and I are on our third round of coffee and cake, and I want to return to a central idea in General Honoré's psychological program, one that taps into understandable right-wing anxiety about good jobs, that in America, you must choose between jobs or a clean environment. Many Louisianans I spoke with told me that either by intent or in effect, environmental regulations kill jobs. This was the idea behind talk of environmental wackos. But Templet refers me to a 1992 study by the MIT political scientist Stephen Meyer, who rated the 50 states according to the strictness of their environmental protection. Meyer then matched regulatory strictness to economic growth over a 20-year period, and found that the tougher the regulation, the more jobs were available in the economy. A 2016 survey of the world's major economies also found that strict environmental policies improved, rather than handicapped, competitiveness in the international market. If this was the growing consensus among Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, economists, I wondered why my Tea Party friends weren't hearing about it. Perhaps because of two final parts of Templet's picture: a growing dominance of oil and its show of generous company largesse. As companies squeeze favors out of the state, he argued, the more urgent its citizens' needs for good schools and hospitals, the less the poor are able to use what opportunities exist, and the more atrophied become other sectors of the economy, which further concentrates power in the hands of oil. Ironically, companies often privately give back to the community in gestures of goodwill. To do this, they use the incentive money the cash-strapped state government has given them to lure them into the state in the first place. Dow Chemical gives to the Audubon Nature Institute. Shell Oil Company supports the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. Pittsburgh Plate Glass pays for a Nature Lab classroom in the woods near Lake Charles. Sasol funds a project to record the history of Mossville, a black community its expansion displaced. The Louisiana Chemical Association gives to the Louisiana Tumor Registry. The people of Louisiana are now grateful. Here, Templet pauses for a moment of sad irony. Not just for jobs, but for gifts. The red and blue of pollution. On my drive back to Lake Charles, I considered a discouraging idea. Maybe Louisiana was an oddball oil state, atypical of other red states across the nation. Maybe it just told a story of oil. Was it leading me away from the heart of the right? I had imagined the South to be the center of the right, and Louisiana a center of the South. But was Louisiana an outlier, or was it an example of a nationwide story? When I got home, I discovered an answer. A startling 2012 study by sociologist Arthur O'Connor that showed that residents of red states suffer higher rates of industrial pollution than do residents of blue states. Voters in the 22 states that voted Republican in the 5 presidential elections between 1992 and 2008, and who generally call for less government regulation of business, lived in more polluted environments. Residents in the 22 Democratic states that generally favor stricter regulation, he found, live in cleaner environments. This would be discouraging news for my Tea Party friends. My Berkeley-based research assistant, Rebecca Elliott, and I asked one further question. Was it just red states that were correlated to higher rates of pollution, or the counties of red-leaning individuals within any given state? We looked at the relationship between political views and pollution. For one, we went to publicly available data on the EPA website. There, we found scores for each county in the nation, reflecting risk of exposure to pollution, risk screening environmental indicators, or RSEI scores. These measure the amount of chemical release, the degree of its toxicity, and the size of the exposed population. It is the best measure we have of citizen exposure to pollution. This we linked with a second source of information, Individual opinions recorded in the well-established General Social Survey. We were studying the link between what people believed about the